It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. City leadership made a push to increase minority participation in the city's workforce. Did it work? And how are those goals being dictated from the office in charge? Are warmer winters to blame for more infestations at local restaurants and food centers in Pittsburgh? And we'll preview the Three Rivers Arts Festival, including a performance by a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. But first, studies have shown for years how diversity on boards can lead to better company performance, but evidence alone has clearly not been enough to change corporate culture. Joining us to talk about how Pittsburgh stacks up nationally and why public companies have been so slow to bring on more women, Ethan Lott. He is the research director for the Pittsburgh Business Times, and Ethan wrote this week's cover story on that topic for the Business Times. Also in studio, Rebecca Harris, the executive director for Chatham University's Center for Women's Entrepreneurship. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Your questions and comments are encouraged. Email confluence at WESA.fm or tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Ethan, let's start with some numbers, if you would. Your parent company, the American City Business Journals, compared the makeup of corporate boards of directors from now to last year and as well as 5 years ago. Summarize, what was found out?
Right. So we have over 40 papers in the chain. So we had some coverage. We wanted to look at across the board here. And at over 3,000 companies, around 12% of the board direct members were women. So basically, a board had 9 members. One of them was a woman. That was across the board. Large companies, the larger companies, were more likely to have more diversity. And that showed right from top to bottom, the really small companies were more likely to not have that diversity on the board.
Was the ratio, though, with the large companies when it comes to large boards? So if you have a board of 9 and one's a woman and maybe you have a larger board of directors, was that ratio still in play, though?
Yeah. In general, the boards of directors are all 6 to 15 members. Public companies don't have, they're not like the University of Pittsburgh with scores of members on their boards of board of directors. So typically the average board had 9 members and had one female, 1.2 women on the board, I believe. Pittsburgh, on the other hand, was a little ahead of that. Among the companies that we looked at, which was about 35 companies, at 17.5%. So a higher number, an encouraging number in that regard. Embracing that the diversity is important.
Rebecca, would you use the term encouraging?
I would say we're right on the way. It's not an end game. It's a process. And certainly the awareness is the key in moving forward. If all of you remember in 2017, the Fearless Girl statue, which was in Wall Street and sort of facing off with Wall Street, and it really raised the awareness of women on Wall Street. And I see we see the continuation of that awareness. So it is a great start. We're not at the end game.
Okay. Speaking of end game, female representation going up, as you cited, Ethan, both nationally and even at a greater degree locally. But it doesn't come close to, 50-50. Are we still looking for smaller incremental gains, though?
Yeah, the organization 2020 Women on Boards has been a campaign, a national campaign. They have a local group, and that goal was to get 20% board representation in the Fortune 1000. That organization met that goal. So those very largest companies have a 1 in 5, as you say, not 50%. You're starting with a goal of 20. Because they hit that goal, the next step then was to look at the Russell 3000. So widen the net. And that goes to what I was saying, that where if a company is $100 billion market cap, they're going to be around a quarter of the board, maybe women, 23%. Whereas if you're $100 million to $500 million, it's under 10%. So the smaller companies, they look to the larger companies for best practices. The companies that are smaller companies that are private look to the Fortune 100, Fortune 500 as their benchmark. So as more companies are doing it that are large, the smaller companies one expects to follow.
And I think that's really true because a lot of research has been put into this, and companies with gender diverse management teams and also gender diversity on their boards tend to perform better and be more profitable than those without. And it makes common sense. We're above 50% women in our population. And so really incorporating the viewpoints and what women bring to the table, it's very critical in moving businesses forward.
Well, I'm going to follow up on that about diversity at the top level impacting a company's financial performance. Is there hard data to back that up rather than maybe... It seems like it would be logical.
There is hard data to back that up. There have been numerous studies. I wasn't looking at recreating the solid and well documented fact that if you have diversity on your board, diversity of ideas, not just with women, but with minorities, with disabilities, with any diversity that allows you to have more ideas, more points of view on your board, that it gives the board of directors a better base to make their decision. And executives or institutional shareholders are demanding that. They're demanding that boards be well governed, and their list of things that make a well governed board includes that diversity. And so, if you're not doing that, you're going to hear it from your very most important shareholders.
And I think as we've looked at some of the very strong academic research, as well as like McKinsey and Reuters and Credit Suisse, certainly we are seeing that boards that have women directors tend to have slightly higher accounting returns, such as return on assets and return on equity, than firms that have fewer directors. But again, the amount is small, and there's been some debate in these studies. I think overall, as we start to look at these numbers, though, it makes common sense as well, and it also will affect the bottom line as investors look at companies and look at their diversity quotient.
So there are the measurables, but is there also that sort of intangible, whether it's the shareholders or the general public, that take a more positive or have a more positive perception of the company that is more diversified in its board leadership?
I think that's true. I think that it's the most important to a board of directors in the end is going to be what the shareholders are saying and especially those institutional shareholders. So even if the public is saying we need to see more diversity, if you're in an industry that the shareholders aren't clamoring for it, or if you're a public company that has to answer less to your shareholders, you may not have as many of those you may not listen. But the companies that if you're a large company, you need to appeal to those investors.
And I'll add on to that to say that as we've looked at this, women differ from men in their knowledge, experiences, and values, and bring this type of information to the table. So it's called cognitive variety, and that seems to make a big impact as well. And when we're looking at women named to corporate boards, when you take into account the fact that women are being named more and we're seeing minorities and much more of a diverse population be named, then the key is they have to speak. We have to speak. If you get to the table, you have to speak. And I think that's a very important point to bring up, because if we get there and we don't talk, that's a problem.
Ethan, when we began this conversation, you used the figure 12%, and you gave as an example, if you have a 9-member board, you're basically talking about one woman on the board with that 12% figure. So I'm going to ask you that in your report, you said the real magic comes not only when one woman gets on the board, but when three, why three? And I'm going to ask both of you, how can three make a difference?
Well, I think that probably plays into the most recent comment about the about speaking. You have to speak. So if you're the one woman on the board, you may find it harder in order to speak up. If you're the only anything in a room, it can make it harder to speak up. One of the people that I talked to for the story, Sarah Stewart, said that she often finds that it's the woman director who asks the question that everybody is thinking about, but nobody said it yet when she's observed boards. And I think that's interesting. And that is something which is probably easier to do if you have another woman board member on either side of you than if you're the lone wolf in the room.
And I think that's true. The cohort of the women together, you gain strength from one another. And I really tried to look at some of this hard stats on this, and I did not find any really strong studies saying that this was the definitive number. But it seems to be that when you get more than two, you have more influence, you have a stronger collective voice, and we see that impacting the entire board.
All right, Rebecca, I want to follow up with you. What are some of the top skills that publicly traded companies are looking for when they look for board members?
And I think this is a very important point to take into consideration whether you're a woman or a man. The top 20 skills that were disclosed by the S&P 500 companies, and this was in a report that we pulled, number one was finance, number two, international experience, number three, industry experience, number four, leadership, and number five, marketing or public relations. And those are strong, very data-driven fields. Leadership, I think you gain by being a leader. But I think when you look at the others, you really have to have been immersed in and understand these areas.
Yeah. Ethan, I believe you reported that, in a sense, private board experience is helpful. So is it you're sort of working your way up from a private board of a smaller company to maybe a board of a larger company or what?
Right. The local to the 2020 Women on Boards local organization had told me that their next step locally was to try to increase board representation on some of the private boards. And that does make sense because a public company is looking for certain qualifications. It's important sometimes that you expand those qualifications when you're trying to bring in more diverse members. You can't require that everybody already be on a public board, have been on a public board before in order to be on your public board. If you want to expand, that just obviously doesn't work. But if to meet the requirements that are definitely going to be in place, that experience is great. And nonprofit boards have traditionally been a first step toward in that regard. And private company boards, large private company boards, bring a lot of the same type of experience that you would get on a public company.
All right, we have just 90 seconds left. We hear a lot about the Rooney Rule in sports. The mandates started by the late Steeler owner, Dan Rooney, who said at least one minority candidate had to be considered for top-level positions, NFL teams, coaches, general managers, et cetera. Is there any comparable strategy happening in the corporate world?
Well, this was so exciting. When I read this on May 21st, it was reported that Amazon has adopted the Rooney Rule. Now, there you go.
But is that just a check off the box for anybody? I'm not saying Amazon.
I understand what you're saying. I think if it's informed, if it's complied with, and if it's done with intent, then I think it's a really important step forward. And I think that we should wait and see, but I think it's a great step in the right direction.
Is there anything else?
And I would add that you can't become a board member until you're considered, until someone looks for the pool and says, what is our pool of possible candidates? And so just creating a pool of candidates that includes diversity, women, minorities, means that now you have said who meets these requirements, who meets our minimum requirements to even look at them. And once you examine those people, you are much more likely to realize the value that they could bring to your board of directors. You're significantly more than if you didn't have them on your list at all.
30 seconds. Is there anything consumers can do?
So consumers can demand of the companies that they invest in that these companies take into account the importance of diversity in their boards.
And Ethan?
I would echo that. Our readership is largely the people who are working in these companies. And so I think it's continuing to ask that your investments uh, speak to that, to this issue that they're going where there's that representation.
Ethan Lott is a reporter and research director for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Rebecca Harris is the executive director for Chatham University's Center for Women's Entrepreneurship. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. What do the NFL hiring policy for upper management and the city of Pittsburgh's workforce diversity have in common? We're going to talk about that in a new report on the city's workforce with Christian Morrow, reporter for the New Pittsburgh Courier. Welcome back to the program, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Okay, we talked about the Rooney Rule just a few minutes ago, named for the late Steeler owner who insisted that clubs interview minority candidates for openings for head coaches and GMs. Last spring, Mayor Peduto said he wanted to, in essence, enforce a Rooney Rule within the city government's hiring policies. How so?
Every opening position would make sure that at least one minority candidate, if not more, were interviewed for the position.
Okay. So let's mention a few key details that you reported on from the city's new diversity report. According to the 2017 census estimates, 34% of Pittsburgh residents are minorities, including the largest portion of that being African Americans. But the report found its city jobs are filled by 21% minority employees. You spoke with the Deputy Director of Personnel and Civil Service for your piece. She was hired to increase minority hiring and promotions. What was her appraisal of the situation when she took on the job?
When she first took on the job,
this is Janet.
Janet Manuel, who is now director, not deputy director. So she's been promoted.
Okay.
Her initial, look at the city and its population was that drawing from, say, a pool of 25% African Americans was kind of a small starting place to start with, and it might be a difficult row to hoe. And that public safety in particular would be regardless of the talent pool out there. But she said, they're going to run this report. And she got back to us when it was done and gave us the stats for a year's worth of employment data.
She gave an assessment? I mean, is she pleased or not with the year's worth of data?
Well, to quote her, she's a hard sell. she would obviously like it to be higher, but if you look at some of the data, the African-American hiring year-to-year, April 19 to April 19, was 15.9%. Now, granted, that's not anywhere near 25%.
Yeah, so that's new hires April of 17 to this past April, right?
For a one-year period, exactly.
And the thing is, we don't know per se, or do we, that they might have been replacing other African-Americans, or they could have been replacing white workers.
Yeah, you don't know what the overall tilt of that was. It doesn't say. The overall composition of the city government stands at about 21% African-Americans, minorities inclusive,
right. Excuse me.
The replacement data wasn't immediately available. But this was just hiring data we're talking about.
Right. The biggest chunks of city employees come in the public works department and public safety, by far, combined. Has the city tried to intensify minority recruiting process, especially for higher level positions within those public works and public safety?
Well, I asked Janet about that, and she indicated that, of course, it would be advantageous the more minorities you have in management, hiring, firing type positions, the better your chances of diversifying the workforce altogether. But again, this Rooney Rule has only this is 1 year's worth of doing this with the Rooney Rule, and overall, she's pleased, quote unquote, not not ecstatic, but pleased. She'd like to see higher numbers everywhere.
Yeah, she also referenced other cities are struggling with this.
Especially with public safety, yes. Mm-hmm. Because the nature of the job itself, the nature of police-community relations, they're strained in a lot of cities. Not a lot of minorities want to be identified with them. And just the nature of the job itself, it's a dangerous, tough yes. job. Tim Stevens, in a follow-up piece I did for
head of BPEP, yes.
he said, you couldn't pay me to do that job.
Yeah. Well, city jobs aren't the only ones top of mind for Bill Peduto. The mayor signed two executive orders this week to increase local minority hires in municipal construction projects.
And we're either going to find them in places like Homewood, Hazelwood, and The Hill, or we're going to find them in Ohio, West Virginia, and Maryland. And I'd prefer trying to be able to find people from this city and this region to be able to fill those jobs.
Chris, you covered that press conference announcing that. Kind of ambitious aims for greater inclusion, especially in high-dollar projects. But what comes next? How are they going to enforce these rules?
That's another problem. One of the mayor's staffers noted that their goal here is to get 12% people actually 12% minorities actually on work sites. So this is they're kind of throwing the ball to the union, saying get these guys on the job sites. And staff admitted that they haven't been anywhere near 12%. But this is over and above the city's goals of 18% and 7%, I believe, respectively, in all contracting for minorities and women.
So they're relying on the goodwill of contractors and labor unions?
To a certain extent, they have to, because, contractors and unions have to make what's called a good faith effort. They can't. The days of quotas are long gone, thanks to the Supreme Court. The best they can do is the best they can do, and they're going to shoot for 12%.
Christian Morrow is a reporter for the New Pittsburgh Courier. Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, there's been a sharp increase in alerts for rodents taking over Pittsburgh food establishments. Who or what is to blame? That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Barbara Lutarowski, the founder of the Mattress Factory on the north side, died this week at the age of 88. Lutarowski opened the venue in the 70s. Local leaders call her a visionary. And an online petition is asking the city to preserve public art atop the 10th Street Bridge. One of the bridge's towers features four painted geese, but the bridge is set to be repainted as part of restoration efforts. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. More and more restaurants, food establishments in the Pittsburgh area are having to deal with visitors crashing the scene without a reservation. Joining us to talk about her report about rodents and restaurants and other food establishments is Patricia Sabatini, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Patty, welcome back to the program.
Hi there.
All right, let me ask you to, dare I say, set the table, if you would. The Allegheny County Health Department so far this year has posted 13 consumer alerts and ordered two places to close because of rodent infestations. First, briefly explain, what's a consumer alert?
It's a bright yellow sticker that gets posted on the door or the window, and it alerts patrons to unsanitary conditions inside.
Those cited, they're not all restaurants, correct?
Right. The county inspects all food facilities, so places like convenience stores that sell food.
Does the food have to be prepared there or just packaged food?
No, some packaged food places, they inspect those too. Dollar stores that sell packaged food. There were a number of dollar stores that were cited.
What kind of infestations are we talking about?
There's some pretty gory stuff.
Mice, rats, something else?
Both. It was mostly mice, but there were some rat problems, too. They found droppings on shelving, on takeout containers, in the customer seating area, in a popcorn popper, outside of, around a pretzel making machine, in this one convenience store that's been cited a number of times for the same problem. There were droppings and urine stains on all over the shelves and on packages of potato chips and other snacks and candy bars and chewed open packages and pretty rough stuff.
Variety of places. Is there one that you were talking to the health department and other sources for this story that sort of maybe even disgusted inspectors? Anything stand out for them? Or is this sort of run-of-the-mill that maybe they come upon?
Well, they've definitely seen increased activity this year. There, like you said before, there were 15 places that were cited so far this year, and that compares to 8 in all of last year. So there definitely is activities up. It's, I mean, it was a mix of places, mostly restaurants, but there were some dollar stores and a convenience store.
I guess there are levels of disgust. I mean, droppings on the floor, all right. But you said in the one place, droppings inside a popcorn popper, for
yes.
example. So inside, right where the corn is popped and sits there waiting to be bagged up.
And where all the crumbs are, and that's, so that's where the mice want to be, right.
So are there levels of sort of citations? What's the process when a complaint is filed or how the health department finds out? What's the process?
Well, they go once a year to most places, and they go more often if there's a problem. But a number of these were tips from customers. So they go out and they inspect the place. They look for evidence of people complain about seeing a mouse, so they go out and check the place out.
You mentioned droppings on actually dishware, stuff that people directly, customers, come in contact with. Is there a severity level there as opposed to something on the floor? Because
we're not
eating off the floor.
No, I mean, they actually note on the inspection reports whether they are old or fresh droppings.
Oh my.
So fresh would be worse because you know that it's not just something that happened in the past or something going on presently. But it's all bad. It's people should pay attention to it. It's a food safety issue.
And this is, you found this, all these examples, are they all in the city or some outside the city?
No, all over the place. And, you know, I talked to a pest inspection firm, Witt Pest Control, which
right.
is in Pittsburgh, more than 100 years old. They said that their calls for rodent problems are up threefold in the last few years, residential and commercial.
Do they have any reason for wherever it is, whether it is a place we eat or get food or whether it's in our own homes? Do they have any thoughts about why the infestations are up?
Yes. They tell me they think it's because of the relatively mild winters we've had the past few years before this year. It allowed rodents to reproduce more quickly. Mm-hmm. And also there's a lot of construction in the city and elsewhere, and that stirs them up, and then they have to look for other places to forage.
I would have thought that maybe open-air eating facilities would have been an issue. Is there any aspect of that?
The health inspector I talked to said she thinks that is a problem, the trend toward these big garage doors being opened up, because it's an access point for rodents.
You mentioned early on about the numbers of citations and closings. Is there a sense that it's peaked, or they expected the number to keep growing? Is there a handle on this?
No, I mean, at the newspaper, I mean, whenever we see an alert or a closure, we post it in the paper, we put it on our website, so we keep track of it. It's been going pretty steady this year.
So, Patty, besides disgusting, this can be a serious health issue.
Absolutely. You can get some pretty nasty illnesses. One of the big ones is salmonella, and you get severe vomiting and diarrhea. That's transmitted by food contaminated with droppings or urine from rodents. There's also something called hantavirus. It's a virus.
And that's even more severe.
Yeah, it's a respiratory illness. It can be fatal. You get that the same way, but also you can get it by just breathing in the dust from droppings. And the droppings don't have to be actually, you know, on your plate. Think about if you go to a convenience store and pick up a bag of chips, there were droppings on it. You didn't notice the droppings fall off. But then you touch the bag, you open the bag, you eat the chips with your hand. You can get contaminated that way.
Patricia Sabatini reports on business for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Patty, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also joining me in studio is reporter Hal B. Klein from Pittsburgh Magazine. Hal covers the restaurant scene in Pittsburgh. Welcome back to the show, Hal.
Thanks for having me back. Good afternoon.
Your questions and comments are welcome. Email confluence@wesa.fm or tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence. Hal, restaurant owners, you talk with them all the time. Managers, they usually focus on menus, making sure they've got enough food supplies to prepare for their customers, their employees, their scheduling. So are rodents typically on their radar?
I mean, I think a lot of it is. You know, that's one of those things that we don't see in the front of the restaurant all the time, right? But when new supplies of food are coming in, when deliveries are coming in at the end of the night, you know, I'm sure most chefs actually care about, you know, the cleanliness of their restaurant and the public spaces and the private spaces.
Yeah, so, they're just opening up just to bring in the supplies.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, and they're, you know, they're seeing that all the time. And so I think, you know, I don't think there are a lot of chefs that are walking around thinking, oh, I don't really care if there are mice downstairs or anything like that.
Okay. So, now, yeah. This time of year, you know, we're enjoying the warmer weather. A lot of us like to sit out and be served if the restaurant facilities can accommodate outdoor dining. That open-air dining can be sort of an open invitation as well for unwelcome customers to come on in.
Right, yeah. You know, there's all sorts of things that are, you know, you're sitting out there, and it's not just mice and rats in that case. It's also birds, insects. A lot of things are about, you know. So I think, again, it comes down to, are the people that are working that section of the restaurant making sure that food is left on the table, is being brought back in really quickly, is the trash being picked up, you know, are people really making sure that the cleanliness of the outside, because that, you know, is one of those spaces that as soon as there are a bunch of leftover food, especially on a hot day, you know, you're going to start seeing flies, birds, you know, hopefully you're not going to see mice or anything walk up while you're eating dinner, but, you know.
Right. Now, earlier, we mentioned that the number of alerts issued by the Allegheny County Health Department has really jumped this year. Do you have any sense of any restaurants or eating establishments that are revisiting precautions specifically in response to this jump in the number of alerts? Maybe our customers wondering, or is this just a normal procedure by, you know, valid businesses? They take care of their product and their facilities.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that the amount of alerts rising, you know, is something that's going to be on everyone's minds, right? Because no one wants their restaurant to be closed. And no one wants an inspector to come in and find something untoward happening. But I think, again, a good restaurant owner is going to have a really good plan for cleanliness and a good plan to make sure that at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, everything is in good shape so that this isn't a thing that's going to be happening or recurring at a restaurant.
Okay, let's move it from owner manager to the customer. What should customers look for?
Yeah, so this is one of those things that the customer, you know, obviously you're not going to be able to see everything. You're not going to be able to ask, you know, can I go into your basement and see your storage? But you can do some pretty simple things, right? So is the bathroom clean? If the bathroom is not clean, that's a pretty good indication that the rest of the restaurant that's not seen is also not going to be clean, right? So that's, for me, always, you know, one of the points that I look for immediately. Little things, you know, are the knives and forks clean? Are people looking around, picking things up, looking at things? And then restaurants with open kitchens are great, right? Because you can actually kind of peek in a little bit. And, you know, it's one of those things that I enjoy most. You know, I like staying out late sometimes. And at some restaurants, you can look at, like, really great restaurants. So Cure, Morcia, with their open kitchens, you see them at the end of the night, you know, scrubbing everything down. I remember going to Salt of the Earth when it was open and seeing that. And Superior Motors is the same way now in Braddock. You know, like, they take a lot of pride. The chefs that work the back of the house take a lot of pride in cleaning the kitchen. And in a lot of ways, those are little signs that, you know, nothing's fail-safe, right? You know, what's in the front might not necessarily be in the back. But those are indications that generally the people that are managing a restaurant really care about the cleanliness and the health of a customer.
Okay, we just a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you a couple more questions. If the worst does happen and a restaurant is cited, even temporarily closed, what can operators do to rebuild that trust of their customers?
Be honest, you know, be open. I think this is, it's crisis management 101. It's, you know, when something happens, own up to it. Don't lie because you're going to get caught if you're lying. And invite people in, you know, show people around. And be contrite and let people know that, you know, you made a mistake. Because even in a even in a well-run restaurant, the thing about, you know, mice, rodents, bugs, they're going to find a way in sometimes. And so it's, you know, like, show your practices, let people know what you're doing to make things better, and invite people in, you know, because it is hard. It's, you know, I don't think people get a lot of chances these days.
Okay, Hal, in our remaining minute or so, while I've got you here, I've got to ask you, some analysts say that restaurants can be one of the most difficult businesses to make a successful run. Infestations aside, would you assess for us the health of the restaurant industry in Pittsburgh?
I mean, I think overall it's pretty good. I think you're noticing a lot more restaurants opening. Our best restaurants issue, which just came out, we actually just expanded our list this year from 33 to 40. So that's a pretty good sign that there's a lot of good things going on. But then at the same time, if you look in Market Square, the Big Y Group, which ran Puro, Sonoma Grill, Nola, you know, they just sold. And new restaurants are coming into that place, so there's going to be a change. But I think, you know, it's always a little bit fluid. I think we like to talk more about the new openings and the celebration, but also to recognize that this is a hard business and a lot of restaurants do have a limited shelf life. And now, you know, like the big crisis, both in the kitchen and in front of house, is are there enough people to work in these restaurants? And are there enough people to, you know, cook a good meal, to be trained to have snappy front of the house service? So I think that's what we're going to see next in the future.
And is that partially because of seasonal activity, seasonal availability of workers or not?
I think it's more that just there are more places that are opening. You know, dining out is now our cultural entertainment, right? You know, people don't go to the movies as much. It used to be, you know, like, oh, maybe we'll have a quick dinner and then go to a movie. And now we're going to spend 2.5 hours at a restaurant and that's going to be our entertainment for the night. So you need more people.
Okay. Hal B. Klein is an editor and restaurant critic for Pittsburgh Magazine. Hal, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, there's something for everyone's artistic taste this weekend at the Three Rivers Arts Festival downtown. A preview of what's ahead. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, industrialist George Westinghouse gives his workers a half day on Saturday, creating what many believe was the first weekend. There was no TGIF 136 years ago, but he did encourage his employees to spend time pursuing their extracurricular interests. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for June 1st, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's the first weekend in June, and that means the kickoff of the annual Three Rivers Arts Festival, which will fill the Point and beyond with displays of visual and performing arts for the next 10 days. We're getting a preview with Rosemary Walsh. She's the afternoon mix host and senior producer for our sister station, WYEP. Welcome, Rosemary.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also in studio is WESA's arts and culture reporter, Bill O'Driscoll. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Kevin.
Your comments, questions are invited. You can email confluence at WESA.fm. Tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. 59th Three Rivers Arts Festival. Okay, I know that neither of you have been around for all of them, but you have seen many. I'm going to start with each of your perceptions. How have things changed? Have they changed?
Well, I think over the years there have been ebbs and flows. The music certainly has changed. There was a point where they used to bring in really big names and there'd be massive crowds downtown. And I think there were some issues with that. Then there was a point where, well, the music kind of slipped a little bit. And I think in the last decade or so, the music has been really solid and really nice mix of alternative rock and folk and blues. And I think we're getting the same thing this year.
Bill, whether it's the music or the visual or just the overall mix, how have you noticed things have changed?
Well, the festival used to be 3 weekends. Right now, it's
two. Yeah, 17 days at one point. Yeah.
So that was a big change. That was some years ago now, but I think it still works pretty well. They used to have some more kind of like crazy sort of public art projects. They still have public art, but there were, I think, bigger ones, and that may be a budgetary issue to some degree. But it's other than that, it's still a lot the same, and it's still a lot of fun.
As longtime Pittsburghers, do you think the festival is as important to the region as it once was?
I think it might even be a little bit more important these days.
So?
I think just more people are aware of it. I think it pulls people downtown. I think people like to come down to the Pittsburgh area in a way that maybe they didn't 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, I think people like Point State Park, and it's a great excuse to be out there and just people watch and hang out with, you know, a few hundred thousand of your closest friends.
Okay. So important to residents, visitors. What about the art community itself?
Yeah, I think, for visual arts folks, so one thing we were going to mention was the Juried Visual Art Exhibition, which actually isn't down at the Point, but it's inside at the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust Arts Education Center up on Liberty Avenue. And that's all local regional artists. So that's a great showcase for them. And it's free to get in, and it's usually worth a look. And there's also a local component to the public art this year, too.
Okay. I want to follow up on the visual arts. Does that make things difficult? Because it's just not obvious. I mean, people think arts festival, they head to the Point and just, you know, sort of, but they actually almost have to make sure it's sort of a destination they have to go to find the juried art. Does that make things difficult?
A little bit. I mean, you know, you got to walk a few blocks. You have to be aware of it. But, it is part of the festival, and I think it's one that's really worth seeing. I remember in the old days, they used to have art exhibitions outside, like in the public plazas and things.
Oh, yes.
That was a logistical issue, though.
And the weather would hit, and it would be, oh, yes.
As it always does.
Yes. Okay. Now, to both of you, one of the things you really can't miss tends to be the big installations and one piece of art that is nearly impossible to miss is 6 plates for Annabelle and Maggie. That's the large scale sculpture from Dee, who is so tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Dee Briggs is a local sculptor artist. She did this piece. It's the premiere of it. It's a giant pieces of metal. They look a bit like curling leaves, maybe. It's kind of rusted metal. It sits in that little piece of lawn down by Stanwix, down by the Gateway T station. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty monumental, so it's a cool thing.
Rosemary, you hang out at the Arts Festival. I mean, do you like that? I mean, because these things can be conversation pieces.
Well, you know, that's what art is.
Among people who don't know each other, too.
And also people that may not know art very well.
Ah.
And for a lot of people, this is a first-time experience. You think about those little kids that are being brought down and they're looking at this. And I mean, we've all had that experience of being young and going into a museum and looking at something and saying, I don't get it. And that's fine because it starts getting the wheels working in the brain. So hopefully it does get conversation going and it opens people's eyes as to what art really can be.
All right. And you get... I admit, I like to wander through the artist market. This is a tradition. Do you meander through YouTube?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I always check it out, see what's down there. I bought a belt one year.
I know people that start their holiday shopping every June. They go to the Arts Festival with that in mind.
Okay. So the festival is filled with live performances, theater, dance, lots and lots of music from choral to classical, from blues to bluegrass, from funk to folk. Dozens of musical performances over the next 10 days. All right, Rosemary, I'm going to put you on the spot. Who are you looking forward to hearing?
Oh, there's so many great folks. I want to point out also that they really give local musicians a stage during noontime, but also starting at 5 and 6 in the evening. You can see some great local music. But the ones that I'm really going to point out here on the 6th, next Wednesday, Lucas Nelson, Promise of the Real.
That last name sounds familiar.
Yeah, he's Willie Nelson's son. And when you hear his voice, you'll know he's Willie Nelson's son. But the music is something a little bit different. It's more blues and southern rock. He has backed up his dad, he and his band. So they've been his touring band. So you'll get that feel. June 8th is WYEP Day at the Dollar Bank Stage. And Brooke Annabelle, who was our local artist of the year a few years ago, is going to open. Valerie June. She's this wild woman. She calls her music organic moonshine roots music, and then she changed it to cosmic ethereal heart music. If that gives you any idea, all I can tell you is a lot of blues and roots.
Well, you mentioned Valerie June, so let me add a description in as well. This was from NPR. Have to quote NPR. NPR described her as, quote, an elemental talent born with the ability to rearrange the clouds themselves, end quote. That is some comment.
And I think she would be very happy with that. She's a delightful personality on stage. She's got a great band. And if you try to pinpoint exactly what her music is, good luck.
And that's one of the great things about it. Some music, you can fit some of the artists into categories because that's what they are, but others not. And Bill, what do you enjoy from the musical performances when you go down?
It's fun just to be down there and hanging out. You know, it's just, it's free for one thing. It's hard,
yes,
to, you know, to ignore that. But the variety of it I like, you know, Mavis Staples tonight, you know, kind of a legend. I'm looking forward to seeing her. I'm looking forward to Valerie June myself. Just the variety and the people watching and, you know, sitting on the grass.
All right, we have just a couple of minutes left. Rosemary, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that some of these performers have been at the WYEP studios.
Absolutely. Valerie June's been in here. The Mavericks, who have a great big sound to wrap up the whole day, or the whole festival on Sunday. They have a great sound. We're going to have also Lucas Nelson and the Promise of the Real. They're going to be here in our studios 1:15 next Wednesday.
We'll look forward to that. Bill, I want to get to one more to you, and that is that the arts community is trying to just gain more enthusiasts, more fans, but also do it among younger people to build that fandom, but also maybe some future artists. Tell us briefly about the Faces of Pittsburgh Photo Workshop.
Yeah, this is a project that the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust is doing as part of the festival. They brought in this world-renowned photographer named Jeanette Beckman. She ran a workshop, a street photography workshop, with some local high school kids. And some of the photos they got in Pittsburgh neighborhoods, just street portraits of people, is up on 3 Gateway Center. It's about 36 photos there, just portraits of folks they found in the street. It's really nice.
Yeah, so it's turned into a public display. So they sent the kids, the young people out.
Sent them out.
And how else do you do it except doing it?
Yep. And she said some of them had never shot street photography or even shot pictures of people before, really. But it turned out really nicely, I think.
And very briefly, Rosemary, all right, I sort of asked this, but what is your one thing that you will not miss, whether it's visual arts or music, at the festival this year?
It's going to be the people.
It's the reason. You are such a people person.
I love to go down, and, you know, we broadcast live. We'll be there on June the 8th, and I get to see so many people. And it's Pittsburgh, and that's what I love about it, because every time I think I have an assumption about who Pittsburgh is, it gets changed when I go to the Arts Festival.
Bill, before we let you go, the Pittsburgh arts community lost a legend this week. Tell us about Barbara Ludorowski.
Right. Barbara was the founder of the Mattress Factory. She moved to Pittsburgh in the 70s when not a lot of people were moving here, turned this old six-story mattress factory eventually into this world-renowned museum of installation art, all original work. And she was just a force on the local scene for decades and decades. And it's a real loss. She inspired a lot of people. She gave a lot of people opportunities. And she will not be replaceable.
Yeah, and you've used the term world-renowned, and you're not overselling that. It's amazing how many people, and I don't know that Pittsburghers know about just what a worldwide reputation the Mattress Factory has.
It's the second biggest draw, the county says, for visitors other than the Warhol Museum in Allegheny County.
That is amazing in itself.
Yeah.
And so her legacy will be
there. I mean, you know, the I think the organization is going to remain, and everything she's done, I think people are going to remember it for decades.
All right. Bill O'Driscoll is WESA art and culture reporter. Rosemary Welch is the afternoon mix host and senior producer for our sister station, WYEP. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
And you can find a link to all the arts festival activities at our website, WESA.fm. And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for the program is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Avery Keatley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.